This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Archaeology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Newman, and I'm an archaeologist and assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. And today I'll be talking with Timothy Pocketot, a professor of anthropology and medieval studies at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, director of the Illinois State Archaeological Survey and the Illinois State Archaeologist. And we'll be discussing his new book, Gods of Thunder, How Climate Change, Travel, and Spirituality Reshaped Pre-Colonial America. So welcome, Tim, and thanks so much for joining me today to talk about your book.
Oh, thank you. And it's my great pleasure.
I think just to start us off, I wonder if you could kind of tell us a kind of brief bit about your background, a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Sure. I kind of grew up eating and breathing archaeology because it was all around me. I grew up in southwestern Illinois and we did a lot of outdoor activities. And so I always thought I might become an archaeologist. And ultimately went off to Michigan for a PhD, which was at that time sort of the school to go to, and considered working in other parts of the world. Ended up coming back to sort of the Mississippian problem in the Midwest and Mid-South because I knew it so well already. Since about that time, I had a series of research problems I always wanted to kind of resolve or at least contribute to. And I've been working on those for quite a while, and that includes the really big questions, you know, these big historical questions of like how are people connected across the Americas, and that really then is the what's behind this book.
So did this book come out of kind of previous research projects that you've kind of built out of something that you've done before, or is this kind of something separate that you've always wanted to do and now you're finally kind of realizing?
I do think there's a renewed realization that the topic was important, and it had been people had talked about it, and I had had conversations with an earlier generation of archaeologists who thought that this wasn't being pursued enough. But the turn towards more interest in climate change, and including my own research, where I'm interested both in historical particularities, you know, but also in, well, how are those particularities being structured by the big changes that are out there in the world, led me to really think much more about this. I've done some big projects around the Cahokia site and other places related to that. And there's a few findings here and there that also made me think, like, what's going on here? And so to explain those, ultimately, you got to step way back and look at the big picture.
Well, I think one of the things that I noticed reading your book is that it is very different from a lot of the things that have been written about kind of archaeology and climate change. I mean, it's different in the sense of the argument that you're making, which is bigger and also kind of about spirituality, which is not often something people connect with climate change. But then it's also different in the style that the book is written. It's very accessible. It has kind of this narrative arc where you take us on a journey from north to south. You have these suggestions for places to visit. So can you talk a little bit about kind of, I guess, how you see this fitting in with other types of work in the archaeology of climate change or climate change in the past, and also kind of your intended audience? I mean, is this the audience you always write for, or is this a slightly different kind of book that you've written?
Let me take that last one first, because I have tried over the years to write for a popular audience and, people who are educated and who are interested and really want to know more. And these are the folks that often, more than archaeologists even, ask big questions like, well, how is that connected? And archaeologists tend to shy away from some of those things. I like writing in this style. And I've always been interested in sort of narrative style of writing as well. So telling a story is fun as a writer, I think, and it fits with kind of my approach generally. Now, that the climate change part of that, though, and as you said, it's a little different, because it's what I wanted to do with this book was actually pick up on kind of a very contemporary way of thinking about the past. Sometimes it's called new materialism, or ontological approaches, where you appreciate that people in different places and different times connected to their world in ways that maybe seem foreign to us. We tend to be a bit more alienated from forces of nature, or spirit, especially thinking of them as spiritual forces. But people in the past weren't. I mean, it's one and the same thing. Climate and, the weather is very much something that involves spiritual entities as people, relate to the weather. So I thought I could basically bring a very contemporary kind of theoretical argument into the case of North America without letting people know that it's a fairly sophisticated theoretical argument and sneaking it in using a narrative.
That's great. I will say it's pretty sneaky, but I didn't necessarily read the book and think, this is about new materialism. So well done. But one thing that I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, you kind of alluded to earlier, and that I think is also a way in which the book is kind of different, is that, of course, most archaeologists tend to be regional specialists and kind of focus on their region, write about that region. Your book does kind of take a wide swath of contemporaneous cultures across Central and North America. So I wanted to ask both kind of how you defined, where to start, where to end. You kind of take us on this journey that starts in Guatemala and goes all the way up to Cahokia in Illinois, but then also how you undertook the research for the book. I mean, there's a lot of archaeological information in each chapter. I mean, it's a lot to command.
It did take me 3 or 4 years to work all the way through it, because I did have to do the research along the way. I mean, I was familiar with a lot of the basics, and I'm more familiar with the southwestern U.S. and the Mississippi Valley in general, so that didn't take as much background research. I think it was really important for me that I was hooked into the book as well, so that I could maintain the kind of momentum to do all that research as I was going through it. And the hook for me was the Narvaez expedition, in Cabeza de Vaca, and the fact that here's some people, not very successfully, but they did the kind of the same journey that I was trying to take the reader through. And that account, and then thinking a lot about it and how good it is and how anthropological it is, really kept me going. And so that's why that is woven throughout the book, because that's partly how I had to write the book.
That's interesting. I mean, I was going to ask you a bit about kind of the use of the Cabeza de Vaca account as this kind of anchor in the book, right? That each chapter either starts with a reflection from that narrative that is in the same place you're talking about, or kind of a comparative way of thinking. And so did you I mean, did you read that at some point and think, you know, I want to use this to think about a different kind of journey? Or did you kind of, were you working on the book and you came across that narrative? How did that kind of become the framework for you?
Yeah, I think I started working on drafting the outline of the book. The Oxford editor, Stefan Voronka, had said, you need to write this book. So I said, okay, I'll kind of work on this. And as I was working on it, I hadn't read it all the way through. It's a short narrative, but I still hadn't done it. But then I did. And then I thought, oh my God, this is really, there's a series of really golden nuggets in that account and how they appreciate Indigenous people. And then vice versa, you can tell the same thing's happening the other way. And they discover things that I think help drive it forward. Like, you know, gods, they're talking, they make observations about the very important gods of thunder, you know, that the book is about, and it's right there in this account. So yeah, I guess it was a mutual symbiotic kind of back and forth right at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting narrative move. I mean, I can see where you said, you know, that you like to write, you like to think about the story that you're telling. And it is interesting to have kind of these kind of mirrored journeys in a way, the you know, the 16th century account, and then kind of your description of what's happening in the different places you take us through. And then the fact that at the end of each chapter, there's these nice little descriptions of, if you want to visit these places, what to look for, what to do. It does kind of, you know, it does, I think, prompt the reader to want to take a journey also, not just in the book, but to kind of physically go to these places.
Yeah, I hope so. And then, of course, that part of the book really is drawing on an earlier sense of a book that I was going to write that it never really panned out, and it became this book instead. And that really is rooted in a series of comparative seminars and the work of other people that has been, we have been talking about in meetings and, you know, in places like London or Santa Fe or whatever over the last 10 years, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like the kind of book that requires, that has just a lot of thinking, a lot of experience, a lot of research behind it. It's, I mean, as you said, it's like the big questions kind of require big efforts, right?
Yeah. I almost had to write it. I almost had to write this book so I can go off and now do something else.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. So let's talk a little bit about kind of the book itself, and we'll just kind of, you know, take the listeners through the book a little bit. But in the introduction, you kind of set the stage by talking about the medieval climate anomaly or the medieval warm period. And you sort of tell us about some of the global implications. And then, of course, the book is focused on some of the local impacts. But can you kind of, you know, just give us a general sense of why this is a particularly important moment to look at these kind of, cross-regional historical events?
I mean, it was at least a hemispheric climatic shift that was important in the northern hemisphere, not always in the same way, and that in and of itself is interesting, because that's a lot like what we're seeing today. The climate change happens differently in different regions or parts of the world, and that's super important to appreciate, so that, you know, we can kind of use the past then as some kind of gauge to think about the future. So the medieval period seems to unfold like that, and the Earth was warming after a period of less than active volcanic activity on Earth, so things warmed up. So by the 800s, that warming is significant in some parts of North America and Eurasia, 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, and that's enough to, you know, make people do things differently. But interestingly, it's alternatively wet and dry, depending on where you are. So where it's dry, things, you know, civilizations might collapse, like the Maya. Where it's wet and they're, you know, just wet enough, like the Mississippi Valley, you know, you're going to get corn production's going to be adopted and expanded. And that's exactly what happens. The really cool thing there is that then there's communication, and the same gods, seemingly, it's a pretty good case, I think, the same gods that you see dealing with too much rain one place are also the ones dealing with not enough rain in some other place. So you get this big interdigitated kind of movement or a series of religious movements all historically tied together that happened. And that's very much like what happens in the old world, if you think about it. I mean, those the big religions spread as well as states becoming more able to produce food and build up their stateliness. And so they're comparable in interesting ways. And maybe also, again, there's sort of lessons for today.
Well, so I think I had kind of asked this question more or less before, but just to go back to it in terms of thinking about the scope of the journey that you take us on in the kind of, most of the chapters of the book. So you start us off in Tikal in northern Guatemala, right? And then sort of move progressively northward and end at Cahokia. And so why Tikal? Why is, why northern Guatemala as the southernmost point of the journey? Why not say, Costa Rica or northern South America?
It could have been anywhere. I mean, it could have been anywhere in Maya world, I think. I actually had the earlier iteration of this book, I had gone to call specifically for another reason. And so I had a lot of thoughts and sort of notes about Tikal, and it's the biggest really Maya city. So I thought it's just impressive in a way that almost everybody will be impressed when you walk through that. So I thought that does use that.
And then from there, maybe you can kind of just give a little overview of, then you kind of trace us or take us northward through.
I'm making you work for this, aren't I? So yes, I'm sorry. So we go from the Maya region into central Mexico to kind of then give a bit of a backstory to the medieval period as it happens a little later. But first we have to look earlier what's going on, see the precursors for some of these gods and the temples that are involved. And then when we're looking at central Mexico, we're also then, we then turn and look to sort of north eastern Mesoamerica, and what's called the Huasteca, which is Tamaulipas and Veracruz, right on the coast. And that's important because that place kind of links the central Mexico and the Maya together, because there was migration of Maya into that region, probably now at the beginning, we think, at the beginning of the medieval warm period, which is really interesting because that gets us really close to the United States and things that then happened to the north of that. For a couple of chapters, we move all over and look at the Southwest, which is has its a very complicated and some ways locally specific kind of history that doesn't always seem to mesh as well, but because it's its own entity over there. But then we swing up into the Southern Plains, and there you probably have people who were traveling occasionally into Huasteca, down to this Maya-esque region in Mesoamerica. And from there, it's a hop, skip, and a jump up to Cahokia. So that's how the book kind of proceeds, trying to show that there are these historical linkages. They manifest themselves slightly differently in different areas. So there's circular pyramid building, from the Maya all the way up through central Mexico and Huasteca and all the way up into Cahokia. The Southwest, it's harder to make the argument. There's the pyramids are really more like elaborate architectural constructions of, like terraced circular buildings. History happens a little differently there, I think, and the argument is still ultimately for similar kind of reasons of being tied into these religious movements.
Yeah, it's interesting how, this is something that I think we all tell our students, but that the past in some ways was much more connected than regions are in the present, even the way we've been talking about where archaeologists kind of tend to stick with their regional specialization. And then also, the difficulties produced by national borders and things like that. But that in the past, people, objects and ideas and information kind of flowed a little more freely than they do in the present. And then we tend to assume, right?
Yeah, that's right. And people weren't afraid to walk. And I'm sure there were some regions people avoided, But otherwise, there was a general understanding that there are certain kinds of missions or trips that people were taking that, you know, others wouldn't necessarily molest them. And that's where this Cabeza de Vaca, you know, it shows that. That's exactly what happens to them as they're moving through all these indigenous lands. So that is hard to wrap our heads around, travel. But it's important, I think, at this point to recognize that travel is also about learning and gaining knowledge. And for people in positions to need to know something at some place, let's say where there's some social development, you know, where there's the emerging city, the people who are coordinating activities or who are in charge need to know what's in the outside world. So they're gonna have to travel to find out and to, you know, answer the big questions so they can go back home and say, I know, and here you need to follow me because here's the way the world is. And that ultimately sort of explains, especially in a time of climate change, it's even more important that those folks get to know the world around them.
Yeah. And maybe you could talk a little bit, you mentioned the circular temple structures that kind of that you see from Guatemala all the way up kind of in different, slightly different forms into what's now the United States. But maybe you could talk about a couple of the other things that you trace along this journey. I mean, you have sort of certain gods that you focus on, the certain kinds of architecture, like you mentioned, but also specific objects that are used for ritual dances, like the poles for voladores and the shell objects. Like, you have a few that are kind of particular types of things that you can, that help you trace these movements of people that might otherwise be difficult to reconstruct.
And all of these things are most of these things are associated with, in all of these various places, are associated with a wind that brings rain god, which has different names. And in the north, it would be called the thunderers or the thunder gods. And, you know, Maya has a different name than people in central Mexico, but they're all very similar in that it's not necessarily the rain god, although the rain god works with this wind god, but this is the god that brings rain. And so it's like even more critical. First, you have to get the rain there. So it's kind of a storm god, if you will, right? And so apparently the circular building, which is, and I won't tell everybody why, is kind of a reference to water and rain generally, is then becomes the abode or a place where you also encounter this wind that brings rain god, especially when it's elevated. So you're going up into the sky, right? And what do you see there? If you're in Belize or Yucatan, you know, Guatemala, you see marine shell pendants. You see a particular kind of dagger, which isn't exclusive to this god, but is associated with this god. It's a distinctive kind of lancelet shaped, pretty big. So a lot of mollusk shells, these daggers. The pole ceremonialism, and that's especially pronounced in this intermediate area, Huasteca, where you can still go see it today, right? Which is people basically hang from ropes and spin around and start at the top of this like 100-foot high pole. And while there's somebody playing a flute, which is of course a reference to a wind god, and these dancers or flyers spin around and in a spiral fashion go all the way to the ground. And that's generally an homage to this thunder god. And that's true all the way up into the plains, where this a watered down version of the same ritual occurs and is still practiced by some. And you see this at Cahokia. And the interesting thing about where you see these three or four things that I just mentioned is that there's a real history there. You can track them. It's not like they always did these things. They come as a set and they move in, and Cahokia is the best case. They come in when somebody goes traveling at the very beginning of the foundations of that city, somebody who needs to know what gods are important and probably travel south, brings back the full package, puts it in place, and that becomes then Mississippian culture.
That's really interesting about the package of materials and ideas that sort of moves across the continent. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of kind of the way people talk about the Neolithic Revolution, you know, that sort of like that it's the full assemblage that's what's important.
And it's because, right, to do the to treat the gods correctly so that they don't get angry at you, you've got to do all the rituals involved. And so all the rituals means a whole set of things that would be have to happen simultaneously. You can't just do one thing. And you know, it's not like, oh, that's a pretty knife, I'm going to copy that. Like, no, that knife has power. You can't just copy it, or otherwise you're in violation of some supernatural rules. So you have to do all the other things too and bring them all up together and have the right stories, have the right songs, have the right poetry that you say, you know, whenever you're using those things. Yeah, hence package.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that is really interesting about this for the book that you've written is that, again, I mean, we talked a little bit about at the beginning about how this is sort of different from the way people tend to write about climate change in general, and specifically climate change in the past. But I think one of the things that you are really good at evoking through these material assemblages or the packages is kind of the experience of climate change. And I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about that one of the things that you do is to kind of investigate and tell stories that are centered on these very ephemeral things that people wouldn't necessarily think of as being the purview of the archaeologist, you know, things like weather and water and wind. How do you go about kind of investigating those things in the past?
It can be tricky. And some readers might look at this book and think, oh, there's just not enough for me to be convinced, you know, that this is happening. Because that sort of knowledge does rely on some traditional indigenous knowledge that is passed down or has been recorded by somebody in a written form at some point in time. And it sort of accumulates that kind of knowledge from across the continent, really, and then says, look, these practices are similar and this knowledge is similar. Again, it's not all, it's material, but it's not all like smoking gun kind of proof of like, hey, climate change caused that society to rise or fall. Because I don't think that's what climate change does anyway. Climate change, you live with it and you breathe it in as weather. We're even seeing that today. People don't believe in it unless they experience it. And so we have to appreciate it more as experiential and as people perceiving parts of it, say a weather system, you know, a storm or a flood or a drought. In these terms of, you know, in cultural or in supernatural terms, and not that they're theorizing or there's somebody sitting back and say, we better abandon this city because climate's, you know, there's a drought coming and we want to survive. Like, no, that's not the way it's working. It's the group living through it. I don't know if that quite answers, you know, the kind of question you're asking. It's a tough question.
Sorry. Well, big questions, right? Maybe a related question is one of the things that that you also do in the book. So you bring together a lot of different evidence from recent archaeological finds, from things that have been known for a long time. And like you said, you sort of show us the package of things that is moving as people are dealing with climate change during this time period. But you also, I mean, clearly in the book, you also go on this journey yourself. You know, you talk about the sites to visit, and you have a few, I mean, there's two ways that this kind of stood out to me. One is that you have a few really beautiful descriptions of experiencing the sites yourself. I mean, you talk about kind of diving into the water at Akhtuntunutil Mugnal, this cave in Belize. And then the other thing that stands out is also the kind of, they're not exactly interviews, but that you clearly kind of talked to different people who are regional specialists in areas where you aren't necessarily a specialist in that area. And so, I mean, it's interesting to think about that sort of reconstructing some of this experience of climate change also involves, in a way, kind of like phenomenological experience in the present, but also kind of drawing on, you know, a different kind of experience from other people too.
I think you said that very well. I'm not sure I have a whole lot to add. Certainly, you know, as a professor and as an practicing archaeologist, I've thought for a long time, understanding comes from the experience of it. So even like in teaching a class, you have to show people or allow them to engage their senses in whatever it is you're trying to convince them of. And if you don't do that, it's because it's an abstract notion that doesn't take. And so I think simultaneously have moved to a point where I appreciate like there is no one understanding. There's a diversity of understandings. And so I need to talk to lots of people so that I don't just convey the sense of I have the answer, but instead that the answer is kind of dispersed out there among a number of researchers. In different media and in both kind of the Western scholarly world and also in indigenous people's hands.
Yeah. One of the things that you say kind of in, you know, moving kind of towards the kind of concluding chapters of the book, you make the case that that you mentioned this in the beginning, this kind of new materialist argument about kind of the non-human forces of history. And I mean, I found that to be a really striking part of the book. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that, about how you see, you know, not just that people are responding to these things, but that these kind of natural forces are actually driving driving human history in a way.
Yeah, I think archaeologists for far too long have thought, maybe historians as well, give people a bit too much credit in terms of being intentional actors, you know, who know what they're doing all the time and then achieve the outcomes that they're, you know, they're trying to achieve. And that isn't the way our world works. And certainly it wasn't the way the past worked. And any conversation you have with almost any indigenous elder kind of lets you realize like, well, that's still not the way it, you know, it's still, there's a very different, less Western way of and dealing with the world where it's not just human beings as inspirited actors who have, you know, have souls or who know what they're doing. Well, there's animals, you know, there are inanimate things that maybe move. Water is a really good case. I mean, my dog thinks that water is animate. He will bark at it if it's in a stream. Because it, in a way, it is. It's moving by itself, and so whether or not that, you know, it's an organic, you know, I mean, an organism, it's still something in motion that people has effects on people, and whether they know it or not, it has effects on us. You're trickling with the sounds of trickling water, generally calm most people, regardless of your cultural background, and you can think of other things like that. You know, lightning is frightening, thunder can be frightening. There's so very few cultures, I think, where people wouldn't be surprised or frightened, you know, by such a big booming sound. So I think that kind of thing we have overlooked, that the world is in motion and all these phenomena or materials or substances are always moving. The air, the wind is another good example. And I think that for us, it's probably more of a trick of like appreciating that. I think people in the past were, attuned more. They didn't have the clutter of the modern world and were more attuned to such things. I'm generalizing here probably to a dangerous level. But you could think of a number of things that make people stop and change what they're doing. Dramatic things like floods, but also gradual things like a warming climate. And if people aren't intentionally countering them, as like, I'm going to stop that, or I'm going to intentionally do this over here, then we have to start crediting those other forces with some history-making power, I think.
So can you say a little bit about why, I don't know if anyone has responded to the book as if this is kind of a form of environmental determinism, but just in case, could you say something about sort of why this is not that?
Usually environmental determinism takes, this large scale, hey, climate has happened, and then this society happened because, and there's some black box explanation for it. People knew they needed to grow more corn. And it's at a scale, it's such a coarse grained, explanation that it's not very satisfying, especially to any archaeologist who knows anything about any region in the world where nothing fits that neatly. And I think in North America generally is the case, where you look around all the cultures that I kind of we walk through, they're all different. So it's not like anybody's changing in lockstep, except for this, like these packages are kind of moving around, like we're talking about. So the determinists, it doesn't work. The deterministic model doesn't work. In fact, in some of the same regions, you can see one group kind of collapsing while another group is emerging over the same or very similar climatic forces. So it's like the climate's doing that, but there's a whole lot more going on at the level of people, thing, environment, interaction that is accounting for then what actually happens in that location that you can't know the outcome for sure, but you just know that the forces are at play and something will be changing.
Great, thank you. So maybe then, talking about some of these, the different outcomes to some of the same climate change events or to some of the same conditions, maybe you can kind of tell us a little bit about what happens after this period. So, you kind of bring us into this very dynamic time across North and Central America. And then and then also we're doing it in the context of the 16th century account of some of those same places. So what kind of happens in between those two?
There are great changes in some places. And so there's a whole another climatic shift, the shift towards a little ice age, and especially important in continental U.S., because of the way the Gulf Coast winds and the Pacific air masses meet over the continent, less important in other parts of North America, Mesoamerica, for instance. However, then we pick it back up again, the story back up with Cabeza de Vaca and the whole Narvaez expedition. So there's some change happening, and yet I'm sort of using that later expedition to say, yeah, but you can still see the patterns have been put into place, and they have not eroded away yet. The patterns of the medieval period, the religious practices, some of the same cities are there. So these guys are still getting a glimpse of an earlier world, even though it has changed on them. It's not a direct reflection. They don't really see the medieval civilizations, as they existed in 1300, because 1300 medieval period's over, and you enter this other climatic regime. I hope that explains some of it.
Yeah. And let me ask you kind of two questions about I guess the lessons from your book. So one would be kind of, what are the lessons for thinking about climate change in the present? And then the other is, are there lessons to be learned about how we go about doing archaeological or historical investigations of the past? It seems like you have this kind of much broader scope than we tend to do, that regional specialists tend to do, but also this interesting move of kind of really using this Spanish account to understand something both in the past and in the present. So yeah, are there lessons to be learned about kind of method or approach that we should be doing stuff a little differently?
I think in terms of climate change, and maybe this is just the lesson of archaeology generally, like, why do you study the past? Not because it shows you, little things that people want to go dig up. Instead is to appreciate where we're going. So you have to have some reference from the past, whether it's a recent past or the distant past, to understand really who you are and where are we headed. And I think in this case, you know, a big climatic episode that's similar to what we're experiencing now, and then seeing what happens across North America is really informative. I mean, the big takeaway from climate change is, boy, almost anything can happen, even if it's articulated. It's difficult to predict, hence no determinism, but yet you know that there is directional change everywhere. And then it's like the icing on it is like, and there's like specific religious adoptions that are almost one big uniform historical process. So I guess that's a complicated way of saying that, you know, the past and understanding the past, climate and how people relate to it really is still important to our future. There are alternatives. We need to appreciate there's alternatives and we need to investigate what those are. Now, as for doing archaeology, I guess I would say, go back to your point about regionalism. Like we got to stop being regionalists and also stop thinking that all change in the past is driven by trade, you know, like somehow like an economic motivation is driving all of this change. And like, I think that's hard. There's hardly any of that matters, especially once you get north out of the central Mexico, where there is, you know, clearly trade and commerce of a mercantile sort. But outside of that, it doesn't matter because people aren't going after commodities. They're not traveling to get things that they want to go back home and trade. They're getting powerful things so they can tell stories and, you know, and shore up their positions back home. But how would you know that if you're just looking at one region and say, well, I've got these artifacts. I don't want to look outside of my region because I'm afraid I might say something that somebody's going to criticize me for. So, but we have to. I mean, I think the explanations are simultaneously local and global, and maybe that's another one of the lessons even about climate change. You can't understand one separate from the other. It's not just climate, you know, and society or like how I live my life over here. It's like they are both simultaneously.
Well, and even, the argument that you're making about these packages, you know, there's regional specialties. And then I think increasingly people have material specialties, right? So if you're only focusing on one type of material, you might miss the package. I mean, it's both kind of, it has some very concrete architectural elements, some objects, but then it also has, like you were saying, ideas and stories and gods that, you might miss if you're sort of just focused on your one type of material.
Yeah. If you're treating like lithics as a subsystem or, you know, foodways as another subsystem of some system, and yeah, you're missing it. And nothing happens like that.
Yeah. And I think that's also one of the things that's kind of exciting about your book. I mean, you highlight some evidence that's pretty recent, you know, the round temple in the Mexico City subway station. And so it's, you know, it kind of points to the fact that there are always new things being found, but also that this is a good example that there are also new ways of rethinking evidence that we've known about for a long time. And that the two are kind of pushing archaeology forward or keeping it increasing.
Yeah, that's right.
Relevant.
And you know, in my career, I've also, especially working in the Midwest or Eastern Woodlands generally, some of this is urgent. That is, we have to ask some of these questions now, because if we don't ask them now, we're not going to look for the evidence where it exists now, and it won't exist in 10 or 20 years. Modern climate change, for instance, is impacting like the archaeology of the mid-continent severely. And some of these sites only have a few decades left before they're plowed away, you know, or washed away in some other fashion. So those, the big narratives drive the smaller research questions. And so another reason, right, we have to construct the big stories in order to know what, where we should be looking.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but on this subject of, you know, what are the big stories we have to construct, maybe you can tell us what you're working on next. What's the next book or the next project?
There's a number of them.
Even better.
There's some historical fiction in there. That's a hard nut to crack. I have a bunch of little local filler projects, like the things that I'm saying, we need to go off and look, you know, because now that we have this big narrative, what about these other sites? Well, those are on my list of things to do also, you know. A big book project, I'm not entirely sure.
Well, the historical fiction sounds pretty interesting. Can you give us a teaser of that, of what that's about?
Murder. There's murder. It's probably a century and a half old, and it's something I'm very familiar with. Not in my family. I don't have murders in my family, but stories were passed down through my family. So that's the teaser you get.
Well, that sounds great. Also, it sounds like I'll have to keep track for another podcast down the line. I don't know if historical fiction's really in my purview, but I'll make an exception.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. It was really a pleasure to talk with you and to read Gods of Thunder and to sort of think about these big questions, as you said.
It was my pleasure. I mean, you probed very deeply into, you know, the meaning of this book and the implications of it. So I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you so much.